Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most dashing work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And before we get into the show this week, I'd just like to announce that we're still in the lead-up, the countdown to the comet of APU2 APU BTP. It's coming soon.
Yes, whenever the story ends, it's coming up. So yeah, this is sort of, I guess, our new segment where we start off every episode by talking about something that's going to be in it.
Yeah.
So, Ruben, you should take this one.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have been asking since Pace finished if we're going to do any more. The answer is we want to, and it's up to you. we've put a donation goal in for Pace Season 2. Look, I'll be honest, we've set it at a pretty low amount because we're pretty keen on doing it. So we've set an amount that we think is almost certainly going to be achieved that we can...
I'm still just so worried we're not going to get even that much. There's a part of me that I guess I'm just still worried that like we won't do as well as last time, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah, who knows? We'll see. I mean, it's for charity. So if we do, yes, that's great. If we don't, you know, we might just do Pace Season 2 anyway, but still donate. It's a goal that we want to achieve because it's something that we want to do. Stay tuned, I guess.
Yes, we're just, you know, making sure that people support charity enough before we will commit to it, especially because, you know, that's what this story is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Put in the effort.
Yeah, changing the world for the better.
I don't think we've actually said what the charity is yet. We'll do that next week.
Yeah, we'll announce that next week. Also worth noting, one of the segments that we've already announced is a Pace kind of retrospective discussion with the players. So if you have questions that you want to ask the players or ask me, feel free to send those by email or in comment to the Reddit thread or email them to us at mediaontpodcast@gmail.com and we will take care of them and talk about them during the show.
Yeah. So yeah, literally anything you have, except whether we're doing a Pace 2, because we just answered that one.
Yeah, I already got that question. Yeah, and we've just answered it. So we've checked one off the list already. Anywho, should we get into the actual chapters for this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we start with Dash to Pieces 11.5 in Verona's perspective, and she is chasing after a kid who likes getting hit by cars and just kind of has to deal with a whole heck of a lot of echoes.
Yeah, I love how quickly this chapter just sort of throws us right into like, oh, like this is fucking chaos. Like in the first couple of sentences, a kid's getting hit by a car. Verona just sort of is like, oh, that's annoying. And then she like ditches him, and within two sentences of ditching him, runs into like two other spirits who start a fight. Like you just sort of immediately like, oh, okay, like there's shit everywhere.
Mm.
Like, I guess I left 11.4 with this idea that, like, oh, yeah, there's going to be a bunch of echoes and spirits and stuff, but they're all weak, so they'll just be the Caneteers, like, you know, fucking shit up for a bit, but it'll be easy.
Mm.
And this thing immediately sort of hits you with, no, this is a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? This chapter and the next one, I think the word I would use to describe them the most is, like, oppressive. It's very much... you can just feel that Kennet is struggling under the weight of this.
Yeah, draining would be another one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely took me back to Arc 5 a lot. Like obviously, there's a more like immaterial spin to this, but just Arc 5 had that same sense of when the barrier first went down and we were just swamped with random bullshit.
Mm.
This was a similar thing. Like it just feels like the Caneteers are running around town putting fires out, but for every fire they put out, a handful of other fires are not being dealt with.
Yeah, definitely. It feels like the town is just going to struggle under the weight of this. And the other thing about this is, you know, the Caneteers know that there are other co-conspirators. And this applies to this chapter and the next one. Even the next chapter, we have jumped forward 3 days. And it feels like they haven't had any opportunity to actually worry about that part of things. Like, they just have to only focus on dealing with just the immense pile of shit that is being heaped upon Kennet right now. They don't
These two chapters are just entirely about dealing with the aftermath of dethroning Edith.
Mm.
I mean, that was a big thing for me. I did not realize Edith as a kind of soft lord or whatever was having this much effect. Like, this is so much more than I expected from this like brief afterthought description of, oh yeah, she was having an ambient effect where she kept like echoes and spirits down.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, like it's crazy to think that she was having so much of an effect. I really didn't expect it either. It's kind of wild.
Yeah. And like, it just to your sort of point, like about how they've got other co-conspirators and stuff to worry about, like what it sort of gets me thinking is way back in Arc 3, we sort of talked about how when the Kenneteers in Arc 3 were like, we're going to take out the Hungry Choir, and all the Kennet others were like, it powers you, like a whole bunch. Are you sure about this? And we're like, yeah, it's like, you know, so noble of them to still fight against it, even though it is responsible for a lot of their power. And this is kind of the next step of that, in that they've taken that same position again. They've said, we're going to really clamp down on Edith and take her out, even though she's like part of our power source. And now they're weaker, the town's weaker, they're drowning in new problems. Like, and that's just going to get worse. Like, they're going to have taken a permanent power deficit from this. And that means, like, with each culprit they uncover, they and the town are getting weaker to deal with the next one.
Mm. Yeah, it to me really feels like, you know, Mariska must be fucking cackling, because yeah, every co-conspirator that they have to deal with before they get to her makes the town more and more fucked up, and so that they have to like worry about it more and more. She's effectively invulnerable, because if they took out more people giving them power, the town would collapse.
Yeah, well, because yeah, and it's not just the town, it's the Kenneteers. Their ability to directly do anything to her is not just in the time that they're losing, but they talk about it so much over these next two chapters. Their stuff is weaker now.
Mm.
So yeah, like, you know, it's only going to get harder. And I mean, this is like, this is the thing, this is kind of why it's so noble, because like, it's very easy to sort of talk progressive talk or whatever, but like, you see a lot of people, it's like, you know, when push comes to shove, they're not really going to threaten their own position to help others. Like it's hard, it's something I wish I was better at, but it's like, the Kenneteers are sort of so brave of them to still continue to do this fight when it's hurting them almost as much, probably more than the conspirators.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, it's an interesting spin, because usually in stories like this as well, you get more powerful, like the hero gets more magic powers as things go on. In this one, it's kind of like the Kenneteers, for every bit of training and equipment they're getting, they're losing this other more core part of their power they never really got to utilize to its full potential.
Yeah.
Like, imagine what they'd be like now if they had all this knowledge and had the Hungry Choir powering them.
Yeah, God. Kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the rub. Being a practitioner, the choice is power or, you know, kindness and responsibility.
Well, I guess the other thing is, in this story, it's like the power is more shifting to them empowering themselves rather than getting their power from the Kennet others. Like, as they're losing their power from the Kennet others through learning and practice and stuff, they're also just getting more powerful in themselves, and that's kind of nice.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's not as cool as turning them into a badass, but...
What we say, like, Verona's the one who's really struggling with this side of it, because she's the one who, I suppose we'll get into it later, but she's the one who most sort of relies on tools and trinkets or, yeah, pre-prepared stuff. So she's the one who's struggling the most.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, she really needs her bag of tricks for sure. So yeah, speaking of needing to restock her bag of tricks, Verona goes to buy over $200 worth of refillable water bottles and salt before she goes back out to the battlefield to catch the car kid.
Can we also talk about her, like, jacket here that she just, like, she, like, tosses it off, turns it into birds so she can do stuff with, like, the runes on her skin, and then, like, poses for this flock of birds to reform into her top? Like, that's fucking cool.
Mm. Yeah. These glamour tricks are getting cooler and cooler, which is a bit worrying.
Yeah, I mean, well, she burns through them really quickly, which becomes a problem for her later.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
Yeah, I guess use it while you can before the two Fae in town become unavailable to you.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, I've heard the bigger takeaway for Verona is, like, she turns into a bird about four times in a row here, she comments on, and she's using all this stuff to turn her coat on and off as a flock of birds. And then she spends half of the night without any glamour. sort of like, I wish she would have been a bit less frivolous with it at the start, I bet.
Well, I mean, it's the continuation of her, you know, she is using up all of her bag of tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that we eventually see the repercussions of this expenditure because it's a wild amount of money to spend.
Yeah, it's kind of hilarious that she didn't think this would be an issue so quickly. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that she, like, I guess doesn't even second guess purchasing such a huge amount of stuff.
Let's touch on this now. Well, actually, no, wait. No, never mind. I had a thought, but I'm realizing now it doesn't make sense. So I'm going to delete it from my notes that I put it in later. I forgot the timeline of when they ran into the impulse spirit.
Yes, I was wondering about that part, yeah.
Okay. So I was about to bring it up, and then I'm realizing now this is before they ran into the impulse wraith, so it doesn't really... I was going to make a crack about how she was being impulsive. Doesn't really make sense. I mean, maybe she drew the impulse wraith to them through this impulsive purchase.
I don't know if this is an impulsive purchase, because she explicitly came here for supplies. It's much more not impulsive, but that thing, like, just not thinking about...
Yeah,
the future.
Yeah,
like she was just like, "Oh, we need a bunch of bottles," and then she gets it, and it's like a whole bunch of money. She's like, "Oh well,
that's life." Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it was necessary. And so she sort of had to do it. But yeah, it's definitely like she's just not in a position right now to really be thinking about all the repercussions of all this stuff. Which I mean, you know, I do that all the time, and I'm an adult, so I'm not going to come down on her for doing it.
Yeah. I like that we also see the store woman from Daniel's Interlude.
Yeah.
A fun throwback. I also found it interesting that she seems to remember a lot of this stuff that happened with Daniel.
Yeah.
Which is like, again, just feels to me like the fact that she remembers that means, you know, not necessarily she's aware, but just like the level of weirdness in Kennet is, I think, starting to get to an unsustainable level where I'm worried the town is just going to be like full of aware by the end of summer.
Yeah, no, 100%. That was my first thought as well, is like in this store, like the reason we've picked her and referenced that event is because it's like it's been talked about before. The whole town is sort of slipping into becoming this knot where the seal doesn't hold and awareness is more of a thing, and so it's just like this is our little reminder that's going on in amongst all the like actual fighting of the echoes. We have to remember that like the town's innocents are also just like drowning in this.
The innocent in this town are really in trouble, right? And yeah. I'm kind of worried, like Ken, I guess, is the representation of the town.
Yeah. What's going to happen to him?
Is he okay?
Yeah.
Is he, like, fucked right now?
It's going to be very interesting to see. Like, how is Ken going to react to there being more aware in town? Does it change him? Does it lessen him? Like, he's meant to be the town more than just the innocents. So,
yes.
It must move him more towards the others, I guess, in the council, which I don't really know what that looks like. I'm sure we'll see more of that. And but this is, I guess, just in a pair of chapters that's so filled with wraiths, it's interesting to note that like the one innocent we sort of get some real time with is like, yeah, well on their way to awareness after what are relatively minor interactions with like supernatural stuff.
Who knows what's going to happen to this fucking town.
Yeah.
So Verona runs across some goblins, including Blunt Munch, who she chit-chats with, and he informs her that Toady is the new king of Kennet. What is there a role? The new in-charge person.
Yeah, because they don't use the term lord. That's like a different thing, but it seems like it's a soft lordship, especially after seeing what a clusterfuck Edith's loss has turned it into. Like, I don't know. The thing that like, this makes you think as well, as we're like, as all this crap is going on because Edith's been dethroned, and we're learning about like this actually huge impact she was having as the de facto leader, it makes me wonder, like, what's Toadswallow's effect going to be, do you reckon?
Yeah, there have been a lot of goblins in town. Is this going to be good or bad for that?
Yeah, like, was Edith suppressing the other spirits and stuff kind of because she wanted to? Or, like, yeah, because, like, does Toadswallow being the new leader mean more goblins or less goblins?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because with Edith, it meant less of the other stuff, but was that, like, a decision she was making? I think it probably was. So it's like, because obviously we know Toadswallow wants to build his market. Like, it just feels like that has to be where he starts to go from here. Like, he's going to be building up numbers and starting to get ready to build his market, right? Like,
I mean, if I was him, I'd take the opportunity to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, everyone knows it's his plan now. It's essentially out of the open.
I mean, people have effectively voted for that plan.
Yeah. Like, so, yeah. But, like, yeah, I guess I just wonder, like, it sort of suggests to me that when he's in charge, this more, like, he overlaps a bit more with the Carmine stuff in essence. So is he going to temper the effects of that or enhance them? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Who can say?
Yeah, I mean, like, the big thing is obviously, like, him as the leader has basically no effect on all these ghosts and wraiths because he's, like, a very material other. Like, goblins are very material. They don't interact with the immaterial stuff very well, so he doesn't affect them. And that just sort of made me realize as well, almost all the big hitters in Kennet are very material focused. Like, John isn't that good against echoes and stuff.
Mm.
Blunt is another goblin.
Mm.
Nibble says he can interact with them with death stuff a bit.
They're very physical, huh?
Yeah, but like most of the heavy hitters are the very physical stuff, and it's kind of like, I can see why this is affecting the town so bad, because all the people who are meant to usually do the most work are the ones who can't do well against these guys.
Yeah, I wonder what Alpia is like in a combat situation.
Oh, Ruben, she's so busy with her work. She couldn't
possibly. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I guess her work is going to be pretty busy at the moment.
Yeah, you think she'd be the best to fight this stuff, but yeah, I don't know. We didn't see or hear from her at all.
Mm.
Maybe.
Yeah, same with Rook, who I suspect might be okay at helping to deal with this stuff, but who knows.
I imagine Rook is kind of handy with just about everything in equal measure because she's the whole thing will be like affecting them in different ways.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, the other question is what sort of effect would Miss have been having when she had this role?
Mm.
I suppose it was less pronounced because of the barrier, but yeah, did Miss help keep the town isolated and like out of focus? Like, that'd make sense.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, this has really made it hit home, huh?
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows how it works? Maybe we'll get a chance to see if Toadswallow is the next to, you know, get the lordship of Kennet, or whatever you want to call it, is effectively a real defense against the dark arts style position, right? Like, you know, it hasn't gone well for anyone who's had it so far.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not exactly a blessing. I mean, the fact that the end of 11.6 skips 3 days is the really exciting part, because it means the next time we do see Toadswallow, he's going to have, like, had time to find his feet, you'd think.
Yeah, and so realize what a mistake he has made by accepting the position.
Yeah, or see what plans, if any, he's already putting into action.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see how the leadership position fits Toadie.
I think we'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, me too. I hope so. So yeah, we also find out Monty is going to be on the perimeter twice a week, twice a night now. And yep. I think it was interesting to me because, like, I think we already talked about this previously, but Edith being in charge meant that Miss couldn't come back in because Monty was kind of a barrier to that. And now Monty is on the border even more, which is like another strike against Miss being able to come back into the town. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like another distinct setback.
Yes, exactly.
That is a result of them dealing with Edith. Is the town's more vulnerable? They need twice as much Monty. It pushes Miss twice as much away.
Mm.
There's a throwaway line like later in this chapter where they're like, "Oh, Rook said the witch hunters are being distracted," which just sounds like Miss is on the case. So I mean, she's keeping busy, but this really dashes any hope I had that she would come back to town anytime soon.
Do we trust Miss?
Oh, God. Yes.
But do we?
Yeah, go read 5.D again. Like, from memory being in her head, it was pretty convincing.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Yeah, I don't know.
I think there's room to tinfoil a bit about Crook.
I think there's at least one big twist coming up before this story's over, Elliot, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's going to be Miss.
All right. Well, I'm saying it. I'm not committing to it, but retroactively, if it does turn out to be true, I'll pretend I did commit to it.
I can't be mad at this tactic. I often employ myself.
Predicting things is really about volume of predictions, not about any real convictions.
It's a quantity game. It's not a quantity.
Yeah. I can point back and you know, cherry pick this exact... I almost said cherry pop. Cherry pick this exact piece of audio.
The problem is my, like, memory is so dog shit. We might have said a bunch of correct things early in this podcast and I don't remember them. Like, they might have all been wrong, might have been 50-50. Like, I have no idea.
I think in about a year, when Pale is finished and we get our first batch of people who go and do a full read-through again and listen to our podcast, they'll point out, oh, this was correct, that was correct, and then we can celebrate then.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope they can say that.
Yeah, true. I hope we get the opportunities to have been correct. So what were we talking about?
We were up to here.
Right. Yeah. Okay, here's another thing to point out. There's a line that comes up where Verona remarks on how these spirits aren't listening to practitioners, even though they should be. And Paul calls out, like, it seems like they're being pushed by the ones behind them, which is gives this, you know, a visual of, like, a crowd swarming. But I think it was just interesting to pull out the idea that, like, they aren't, even the kind of expectations of the world are breaking down a bit because of what's been happening in Kennet. I just, you know, regardless of whether it's the kind of crowd metaphor that is accurate or not, it feels important to me that things just aren't acting how they're supposed to.
Yeah, I think that feeds into both the fact that Kenneteers are weaker now, the fact that Kennet is, like, falling apart, like, Seal of Solomon-wise. But to that sort of quote you read out, I definitely got much more of, like, a mobbish sense to, like, to all the echoes, like, this real idea of, like, you know, the Horde of Zombies style. There's no chance for the Kenneteers to try and, you know, do, like, so far in the chapter, they've been going up and, like, dealing with individual echoes and spirits and kind of managing to contain them and make promises of shrines and stuff and, like, work peacefully with them, and now they're faced with this just horde of echoes and stuff, and it's like they can't do that now. Like, this is just they're just gonna have to sort of meet them with violence because it's the only thing they sort of can do.
Yeah, it is, I mean, obviously they're kind of making bargains with some of these spirits, which is good when they can, but they are being forced into destroying them fairly frequently.
Yeah.
I haven't really formed my thoughts on how I feel about that, but it's not great.
No, and the Kenneteers don't like it either. Like, that's a key point, is they're not happy when every time they have to do this. But, like, yeah, like, there was even a part of me at one point that almost wondered if, like, at certain points it almost feels like the spirits and the echoes are, like, revolting. Like that they're angry about. I don't know if there's any evidence to back that up. It's just this sense of, like, the way there's hordes of them and, like, they naturally gravitate to each other. It just feels like the Kenneteers are fighting this, like, mass that's sort of coming at them.
Yeah, it's dehumanizing these spirits and echoes, right? At least in my mind.
Yeah, well, it's like that, I think it's from Men in Black, there's that sort of quote where it's like, a person is smart but people are dumb. Like, when you get people in an angry mob like this, it just becomes a lot easier for shit like this to happen.
I don't know what it means. I don't know what the solution is. It's just feels like they've gone down a step, but the situation has forced them to be more callous.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, it's just made things worse in every way, and this is just something they have to do. They've plucked a really important part of the ecosystem out, and that has caused a bunch of chaos.
Let's pull out a fun little line here where Snowdrop says, "Like when I pulled a fat pickle out of Cherry Pop's throat. Pluck," Snowdrop said. What? What? I'm trying to even understand what the opposite of this is, and I can't, and I don't want to know.
Well, it has to be pushing a fat pickle.
Putting it in, right? That's so fucked.
But then that doesn't even, because the context is that part where they're like, oh, we pulled Edith out of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
That has caused instability, and that's what's leading to, this chaos. So, like,
maybe it's a really thin pickle that she pulled out.
Yeah,
maybe she pulled it out of somewhere else.
What's the opposite of a fat pickle? Maybe that's the I don't know. it's a great, like, because I think Verona is also like, what?
She pushed it in there to thin fuck pickle this. Into Cherry Pop's butt. That's what happened.
I think the other great part from all this to me is like when. Verona is definitely in this sort of mode for this part of the chapter where she is like trying to keep the mood light to make everyone feel better. So this is great. But when she first reunites with the other two, she like does this big jump and sort of superhero landing in between them to sort of do this cool movement. It scares the shit out of Lucy, who like splashes her with water.
Mm.
And as Lucy's like, "What the hell were you doing?" Verona's like, "Oh, I was going for a movie trailer style arrival. All of us in formation." And Lucy just cuts her off with like, "Did you get the stuff?" Like, I just love how Lucy doesn't even let her finish. She's like, "Fucking hell. Like, just, did you get the shit that we sent you to get?" I love that Verona's trying to keep the mood fun, but also there's someone like Lucy who's able to keep them on task. It's just such a good team.
Yeah, and it gets played off of the next chapter, which is
good.
So, the Kentius reunite and keep battling spirits together. Getting a bit competitive as they do.
Yes, which is another fun, like Verona, keeping it light, keeping them connected.
Mm.
And we get like a bunch more on Verona's sight in this chapter. Like, I think we talked about this with Malia and Jenny, but like I've only had this super vague understanding of what her sight means, and I feel like I get it more now, which is cool.
Yeah.
Like just sort of learning how the spirits themselves are the meaty parts, and then it's kind of like the shapes and the impressions that are the wrapping, like it all. I feel like I'm now finally 11 arcs in at the point where if we just saw what something looks like in Verona's sight, I can start to make some deductions about what it means.
Yeah, true. It helps us get more info on it. Is there anything we can take from it? I'm trying to think if there's something bigger that we can, I don't know.
Well, I think it really speaks to like her whole focus on understanding like the underlying systems, right? Like she sees through the packaging and into like the core of what something is. Like that is how she tries to operate. So like it really sort of suits her. But we sort of already knew that part. I feel like part of like what I'm finally getting now is that sense of like what the wrapping itself actually means, which is it's very much... I get the impression it's like the effects or the presence something has.
Mm.
So like echoes being mostly just outlines. It's like there's no substance to them. They're very much just a machine kind of playing out is the sense that, she gives here.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess, understanding how it plays into the physical and the spiritual is good. I'm just trying to, the fact that we have kind of not fully understood it, I'm trying to like think back to moments when we saw through a sight and see if there's any like new interpretations we can, pull or anything. But I don't have anything. I'm just kind of trying to prompt that question, I guess.
I mean, definitely, like it's helped me understand a bit better. Remember when the classic one was like the milk, where they're like, "Oh, I wonder if this milk is contaminated." And she looked at it; it was just like a thin thing with like a cow drowning in its own liquid inside, and it's like, oh, okay, like I feel like I understand that better. Like it was sort of like that was like the spiritualness to it was the meaty part of the cow fetus drowning and stuff, and then there was no wrapping because there was nothing trying to hide it.
Mm. yeah Yeah. Anyway, something else interesting from this part. There's, I guess, something that I just kind of want to pull out is the thought that, like, obviously the fact that the town is being swarmed is very physically draining, but just imagining having to deal with echoes constantly and being, like, constantly bombarded with just random powerful emotions, it just would be so emotionally draining as well. It's just a nightmare. Like, they're living through a nightmare here.
Oh, yeah. Like, this fight would be so hard because you can't, as well as the spirits being all these shapes and sizes, so they're coming at you in all these different ways and you have to change it up, just getting hit by, like, emotions, it'd be so draining.
Yeah.
And again, like, there's a number of times the Kennetees here start to get, like, possessed by echoes. Like, the first big one is that gymnast who comes up and, like, really gets Verona under her spell. I don't know if it's just because we haven't really seen echoes that much or whatever, but, like, the Kennetees have never been overtaken by echoes before. They feel so much more vulnerable to them.
Yeah. The fact that it's not here kind of has changed the entire dynamic, hasn't it?
Yeah. In fact, talking on that, the gymnast echo again, I just really wanted to call out, I thought it was so cool that the echo wasn't, like, the event itself. Like, the girl falling off the balancing beam and running away wasn't actually what the echo was. That was the sort of event, but the core of the echo was the months spent stewing over that moment and, like, you know, all the pain and agony of, like, reliving it over and over again. I just really love that detail because that totally is what, like, makes a bigger impression on you and the people around you and really sits with you, is, like, you know, cringing over something you did for weeks and weeks rather than, you know, the event itself. It's such a great detail.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the... God, when I first read this bit, for a second I thought it was Melissa's, like, an echo of Melissa or something. Because it gives me the same vibes of, like, this traumatic... well, effectively, the trauma of spending your whole life dedicating to a craft and then just not quite getting there or having something stop you from being able to do it.
Yeah. It definitely has overlap. And, like, Wavy Tree Studio gets a mention. Like, that place needs to reevaluate how it supports people who aren't doing so hot with them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a... Yeah, it doesn't come off looking that hot in the story, does it?
No.
Montague takes over the perimeter, it starts raining, and the remaining spirits out and about either take shelter with the Kenneteers or get disintegrated. The Kenneteers then run into Matthew, who ensures they get home on time for at least some rest.
Yeah, but most importantly, you didn't even mention it, Lucy finally gets to do her fucking arena again. I'm so excited. We got blueballed with it so hard in the end of arc 9. I'm so glad it finally came back.
Yeah, she's pulling it out a few times in these two chapters, huh?
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's good to see her having a cool trick that she can pull that just works for her so undeniably. Also good to see Matthew, who we see again. He's not doing so hot, but he's still an absolute sweetheart, and he basically apologizes for, well, I kind of felt bad reading it because it feels like it's the kind of apology where he just feels like shit and he thinks, oh, I need to apologize to everybody for me just being a piece of shit, which is a pretty horrible thing to be feeling for Matthew.
Yeah.
Matt, you're a champ. I'm glad I never doubted you.
Yeah, he's essentially apologizing for being tricked. And
yeah, he's apologizing for being a victim. Yeah.
I mean, as you said, he's not doing great, but I think given the circumstances, he seems to be doing pretty damn well. Even the fact that he's out here at all kind of speaks volumes about him and also how serious this situation is. Like, I don't think anyone would have given him shit if he took the night. So the fact that he still sort of came, maybe this is good for him to sort of beat some shit up and also not be in the house when he knows Edith's locked in the basement. Maybe he didn't want to be in the house. He's a good guy.
Yeah. I love you, Matthew. You'll pull through, mate.
I hope so. You feel bad for Verona, though, as well, a bit, because she can't help but connect. Like, when she sees, like, sad adult man, she connects it to her dad, and she just kind of like, she's the one who initiates this. She sort of says, oh, like, Matt, how are you going? And then when he sort of starts to say, I'm not doing so hot, and he looks sad, she just very quickly fades out of participating in the conversation, because she gets uncomfortable. And it just sucks, because you can tell she knows that this isn't fair. Like, she knows she's not being fair to him, but she can't help that, like, just because of her own trauma, like, this is just not something she can't help him. That sucks.
Yeah, it's yeah, it is a major bummer. The connection to her dad is rough.
Yeah, but understandable. Like, this has been so much of what Pale has been talking about, like, this idea of, like, our own shit stops us from helping each other. And this is such a, like, a nice little example of that. Like, Verona's baggage means that she's not really going to be able to be there to help Matthew as much as she might want or as he might need.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's pretty rough. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think they did the best they could by just, you know, sending Cody to hang out with him for a bit.
Yeah, I still think they do well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Although a bit weird that, like, Avery just sort of runs off the second he shows up. She's got, like, good reason. Like, she's got something she said she was going to do, but, like, it just jumped out to me because she's just sort of like, oh, hey, Matt, I'm off. And then Verona's the one who's like, hey, how are you doing? Whereas, like, yeah, like, usually
yeah, that's Avery. Yeah, that should be an Avery thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good call.
They also, like, again, at the end here, run into Blunt Munch. I'm curious, like, what your take is on why he's suddenly around so much, particularly because he brings up this point that's almost so outrageously suspicious, I've written it off as being suspicious because it's so bad. But he's sort of like, hey, what are your plans for the next culprits? And then when they're like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, I don't know about plans. I'm a goblin.
Yeah, it is very suspicious, especially because we kind of are expecting there have to be some more culprits around, and a goblin culprit doesn't really exist yet, right? So Blunt and Toady are really the only two that it could be.
I mean, Gashua jumps out to me as a candidate just because he's been in this story from the start, and he's just had, like he's that one that slips under the radar all the time. I think he had that one moment at the Blue Heron Institute where he, like, pulled some hilarious pranks on Bristow's guys and we all fell in love with him, but it's almost, aside from that, he just hasn't been in the story. And that
that's a mark against them being a conspirator, because they would need to have been characterized a bit more for that to feel impactful, right?
Yeah, true. But then at the same time, like, he has been around the whole time. He just doesn't.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. He
flies under the radar.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. Like, Blunt could certainly fit into that realm for me. Like, he's just the right amount of present and defined, but also often goes like arcs without being mentioned. But I trust him. I don't know. He seems too blunt to be like a grand conspirator.
I mean, that's kind of the case with all the goblins to me, but I don't know. Some goblins have to be bad sometime, right? They can't all just be the best.
Toady would be the one I could see being that kind of conniving, but I'm pretty certain he's not. I have a feeling there aren't any goblin conspirators. I think there's goblins who have, like, at times worked with them. Like, maybe some of the new ones are sort of working for them to some degree, like as spies and providing stuff, but I doubt, like...
Yeah, sure.
I doubt there's a goblin sitting at the table across from, like, Edith and Marissica making plans with them. You know?
But do you think that the smaller goblins would work with them without some kind of bigger goblin to kind of keep them in line?
Yeah, like, because goblins are so easy to bribe. Like, you give them a shitty hamburger or something, they'll do some dumb shit.
Give them a nude and they'll do whatever you want.
Yeah, exactly. I just can't see one being a top-tier conspirator, but I can totally see them being other tools that have been used at points.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I can see that.
But yeah, I mean, Blunt brings up some really interesting points here, sort of about, like, hey, you've made a bit of a mess here. What's your plan for the next one? It's just so interesting that he brought that up. Like, why did he do that?
Well,
I don't think he's a conspirator, but did somebody else get him to ask this? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just like the fact that the Kenneteers have been making waves, I guess, is just rubbing some people the wrong way. Maybe that's the wrong way to phrase it, but it's just the trade-off of, like, people who are supplying power to the town being taken down. Like the Hungry Choir, even if the Hungry Choir wasn't doing anything that in Blunt's mind was actually that bad, you know, maybe he's just questioning that.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, something we haven't seen anyone do, but like at this point must be something someone would consider, and maybe Blunt is that. Is he just like, is there a point where Blunt's just like, this place is gone, it's too much effort, like it's too late, like I'm out? Because he came here as a safe haven from like a goblin queen or something, right? And like, you know, he's left a bunch of times to go fuck with other goblins and do stuff. Like maybe he's just reaching the point where, you know, now that a smaller goblin is in charge of him, especially, he's just going to like be like, fuck it, I'm out.
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows?
But yeah, maybe he's just probing the can of tears because he wants to see, like, if they don't have a plan for what they're doing going forward, he's just going to be like, I'm out.
Yeah, I guess that's the other way that Kennet can fall apart, is if people lose faith in it working as a system.
Well, at this point, I wouldn't blame him. I mean,
yeah,
we'll talk about some of the other new Kennet others and their responses next chapter, but like, yeah.
Mm.
Like, I think that's a fair reaction to have at this stage.
Yeah, I think so. So yeah, the chapter ends with this tragic line of, we'll be trying to keep this manageable until the whole karma and situation is dealt with, which effectively is just Wabo saying, shit's not going to get better until the story's over.
Yeah. Again, it's like that feeling we got in Arc 5 where the boundary went down. And then they're like, it's not really going to go back up. It's never going to be the same again. Like, things just got worse and they're never going to get better. Like, that's where we are again now. Things just got worse again, and they're not going to be fixed before, yeah, what at this stage feels like it's going to be the end of the story. It's just, yeah, really set, like, increasing the stakes yet again. The terrain that we're playing out the finale of this story on just got even worse.
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, until the story ends, that's just going to keep happening with each conspirator that comes up, right?
And just each day, the Carmine Furs are still here leaking power in.
But that's the end of 11.5. Let's move into 11.6, and we change perspectives into Verona's perspective again. this chapter starts the same way as the last one, with the Kentiers fighting a battle against a tide of echoes, starting with a strong wraith who they can't quite figure out.
Yeah, and this chapter really sort of dive straight into this sense that we touched on a bit earlier. Verona feels like she's falling behind. Like, she's talked about her stamina a bunch, and she talks about it a bunch this chapter. Like, she's never been a high stamina person. And now we're cutting to like 2 a.m. It's been hours and hours of this bullshit. And much more than the other two, she's the Kenneteer who's much more reliant on like consumable pre-prepared resources. Like, she uses glamour, yeah. She uses runes,
her bag of tricks.
Yeah, like Avery has tricks as well. Like, Avery, you know, uses like the jump rope and stuff, but that's non-perishable. Like, that she can use that as much as she wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Verona's tricks are all
consumables.
And yeah, so like, as we sort of reach the long haul, she's not the stamina person, and so she's not as good as she'd like to be, and she's also just run out of stuff. Like, it really sort of sets this scene for what the first half of this chapter is for her, which is just, oh, I'm useless.
Yeah.
I mean, she does turn to the one thing she kind of always has in her head, which is her ability to, like, figure shit out. So it turns into a cool lecture on, like, echoes for us, which is fun.
Yeah. I love, like, a good lecture.
Yeah, we learn about, like, poltergeists and all these flavors of it's very
fun. No, it's good. Again, I think the type of information that maybe works the least well on this podcast, which is just a lot of informational content being delivered to the audience. But, you know, you all have read the story, so I'm sure you've enjoyed it just as much as we did.
Yeah, exactly.
Wraiths and echoes as enemies, I think, are interestingly hard to pin down as opponents, right? Like, so this wraith is kind of like grabbing and gnashing at its own face and kind of like throwing emotional outbursts at the trio, but also it's got like sharp claws kind of vibe that it would be physically imposing. It's like a disorienting threat in a number of ways that I find quite interesting.
Yeah, well, especially like big wraiths, like this big incarnation one they're fighting here. They're particularly scary because they're both that physical threat, like this thing comes at you, but also it's smothering you in like these echo emotional bullshit mirages.
Mm.
So it's just like there's so much you've got to deal with because it's attacking you emotionally and physically.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's like you can't let your guard down against it. You can't just fight it on one front either. It's just like, yeah, it's you can't let your guard down, or else you'll falter against it in a different way than you expect to.
Yeah, and like the sort of central thing that comes up about like wraiths in this chapter is very much like this idea they draw the other echoes in. They start to form this like mini domain, which, you know, lets them change the battlefield. Like they're literally this sort of, in this case is one very literally this incarnation of like, you know, toxic and bad ideas that sort of like gather momentum and form this cycle where everything gets dragged in and they just get powerful and they just become like shittier and shittier and hard to deal with. Like it's this great sort of aftermath to that kind of horde mob mentality from the last chapter, where now you've just got like these things forming into just one like bad and toxic sort of figurehead that, you know, is really difficult to sort of fight against.
Mm, yeah. 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 You can't ever, I don't know, you can't ever like know exactly how you're going to need to deal with it, or know exactly how it's going to try to deal with you.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, we see some absolutely horrifying schoolyard scenes here before Verona finally figures out it's a wraith kind of powered by this impulse emotion. But it's too late, as they've pretty much defeated it by then.
Yep, she was not helpful at all. What a loser. could we talk about the visions? Like this Erica girl, I guess. Oh man.
Yeah.
I felt so sorry for her.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, huh?
So, because it's like it's so hard to explain to someone like why, like you can see how she has that mental block where she doesn't understand why what she did is wrong. Because it's like, but it's a nice thing. I bought him a car. Like, how's that not a good thing? And it's like, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. Is do you think I'm kind of for my own health. Pretty sure that Erica isn't a person that ever actually existed. Like, this scene never happened.
It happened.
No, it couldn't have. It's too terrible.
Yeah. It's great. Great, like, sort of cringe comedy.
Yeah, it's rough. so, yeah, well, I guess... There's a point where Nibble kind of tackles her, which is a classic Nibble move, tackle someone who's in the midst of falling apart. and yeah, again, like Nibble basically does the same thing Matthew did last chapter. He's effectively apologizing for being a victim in a few ways. It's just like, oh, they're so nice. These others are all just so nice.
Yeah, it's nice having these guys come in and kind of be these like beacons of light in the middle of this shitstorm of a fight that's been going on for hours. Like, it's almost like the reminder of what they're fighting for, like as they're driving off these wraiths and echoes and spirits, having, yeah, like nice people like Matthew and Nibble sort of come up and just remind them that like this is why they're doing it.
That it's nice to have a reminder that you're right, that the others aren't shit.
Yeah. And so Nibble starts to raise the really good point that we touched on before, which is like he basically is like, hey, I wanted to speak to you guys because, like, what are we doing here? And you can sort of see now, like, all of the, like, second generation, the new Kennet others, have all effectively been lied to about the setup of this town. Like, it came up when the Kenneteers first arrived, where it was like it had been downplayed that the Kenneteers were even a factor here.
Mm.
And then now those practitioners have come and they've locked Edith up because it turned out she was the one causing the shitstorm that they were all fighting against. And like, you could just see how most of them presumably must really be questioning, like, what is this place actually? What is our role going to be here? Like, how does this work? Like, Rook's fine. Liz seems like she was in on it to some extent. Like, but you know, people like Nibble and Chloe have just got to be like, what are we doing?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess what we were talking about with Blunt, right? Just like, shit, is this town just going to fall apart?
Yeah. Oh, you know, they were promised it as like this, you know, this attempt at a paradise away from practitioners or whatever. And now, like, Nibble's got to sort of even be questioning that part of it. Like, he clearly trusts and likes the Kenneteers, otherwise he wouldn't bring this up with them. But, like, I feel like that's something he just has to be measuring is, like, he and Chloe really wanted to settle in here for the long haul, and he's got to try and figure out the people who are running this place, what is their image of the long haul, and is that something he and Chloe want to sit through?
Yeah, I don't know. God. It feels more and more like things are just going to end badly for this town.
Yeah, the good ending just feels further and further away, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with all the hauntings that are going to be taking place now.
Yeah.
The last thing from this whole section, as Verona, I think it's the second time she intentionally gets possessed by the Wraith, she sort of comments on how she just doesn't feel emotions as strongly as any of these echoes. And she sort of thinks like a tiny bit of her felt like she was missing out, not being able to ride these particular roller coasters, but she was cool with it at least for now. Because obviously it's very useful that she is not as affected by them right now. Like, you can tell Avery's probably in the background fucking going for a ride. But I get this sentiment from Verona. Like, she has these very dampened emotions that she's not particularly connected to. And it's kind of just like being hit in the face with what you don't have every time she gets hit by an echo.
Yeah, I guess that's what the echoes are really... That's why they're really fucked, is because if you get one that matches your, what is also your kind of emotional trouble, it really fucks you over.
Yeah, but then also if you get hit with one that is something, like, just, yeah, for Verona, all of them are that to some extent, because, like, something she sort of has here is this idea that, like, she isn't as emotionally accessible or open as she might like to be, is sort of the impression I got from that quote, and she just is getting confronted by that every time an echo hits her.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess this chapter gives me... we'll get to this a bit. Actually, we'll get to this in a little bit. Let's carry on, because this is one of the things I want to talk about in a moment.
Okay.
Which is that Verona and Lucy then kind of part ways with Avery before they then go and try and get some sleep. So, let's get to it when we get to it, I guess. But I want to kind of talk about the emotional states in general of the Kenneteers.
Yeah, fair. I mean, so first of all, it's very nice after all this fighting, just this like this wind down conversation we have as they walk home about like the hypothetical partners they all had.
Mm-hmm. It's like, nice,
Yeah, it's a really good sort of tone changer to help like us as the audience like calm down after all the fighting and get into like the, you know, a much more conversational vibe.
Yeah. God, I mean, any emotional happiness or release they can get after what is clearly a terrible day is you know, a plus in my book.
Yeah. Especially because Snowdrop drops another great teaser on us about like her flea-ridden boyfriend. It's not all sunshines and roses though. Verona's dad, we walk past his house and his grass is mowed. And that is a detail that does not escape Verona's eye and leaves her a bit... she's not sure exactly what it makes her feel, but it's uneasy.
Yeah. What do you think about that? It's weird, right? Like, I've seen a lot of people trying to understand what it means. I have no idea what it means. But the fact that Verona's dad has had his lawn mowed, either he's done it or somebody else has done it, and there are implications in both of those that are just very worrying. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that was the thing for me. Whether it's he did it or somebody else did it, I can't help but feel that the takeaway at the end of the day is that, like, he's going to be bitter at Verona that it had to get done and it wasn't her doing it. I can't view it as this sign that he's getting his life together or anything. He's going to be bitter that he had to step up and do something that should be her job in his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he won't be. Maybe he'll be like, oh, look, I did this because I love you, Verona, and I recognize that I was wrong about everything.
I mean, he's been like that in the past. There was that one time yeah. where he had his shit together for 5 minutes. Like, maybe it'll be one of those. He'll sort of come in and he'll try to play, like, nice, and it just won't last. Because I can't let myself believe that even after, like, you know, if she goes back in 2 weeks, she'll have been away for, like, a month. And I just can't believe that's enough time for him to change. Like, that pattern is just too entrenched.
Mm. Yeah.
Unless he got, like, a real fucking good therapist.
Yeah, imagine. He's been fixed in one therapy session. What a treat.
I mean, God, well then, if that therapist can fix him in one session, let's just get, like, every character in this story in a line.
Yeah, true. One after the other. Boom, boom, yeah. Boom, boom. Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about the dynamic between Verona and Lucy here, because I think it's interesting. Lucy strikes me as being very on edge after the night they've had.
Sorry, I thought of another thing about the grasping mode.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It also just shows that Verona's dad is continuing to present himself as put together, because, like, I feel like grasping mode is just a classic.
I've got my shit together kind of thing.
Yeah, like, it's that sort of, you know, classic American dream, like the well-mowed lawn. And, like, that's why he had her mowing the lawn. It's like, you need to present like your household has its shit together. So it's like,
yeah,
it's both showing that his priorities haven't changed, but that also he's still managing to keep up this veneer of somebody who is capable as an adult. So it's kind of unsettling, because the more he's presenting as that, the harder Verona's cases against him is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, God, that's horrifying. Nice. Nice way to spin it to be even more horrifying than I could have considered.
you were saying about the sleepover.
Yeah, yeah. Just like, Lucy feels like she's not doing great, and she admits to Verona that she's not doing great, right? Like, she talks about how she feels like she almost wasn't able to hold it together with Verona away and all that stuff. Like, yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit worried about Lucy. I'm worried about all of them.
Yeah,
I guess.
Was about to say.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like, Lucy has always been the one who puts things on her own shoulders the most.
Yeah.
And you could sort of see she's coming in here and she's like, we've done this. We need to fix it. My mom just got the job. I can't go anywhere. So, like, it needs to get fixed. I think as well, just from comments she makes at various points throughout the chapter, I think Lucy is holding a lot of, like, indignant rage at the fact that this has felt like a massive step backwards. Like, they put so much effort into making sure they did this right. Edith was guilty. Like, it feels like they did everything right, and this is their reward. Like, things have just gotten worse. They've had to stay up till 2 a.m. fighting ghosts. Like, she has every right to be fucking pissed. And it's been a while since we saw her. I wouldn't be surprised if we've got a Lucy chapter coming up very soon. And I have to imagine she's just sitting on a lot of anger at the fact that this has gone so poorly despite them doing everything right.
Yeah. Despite them doing everything right, the fact is, being a practitioner, if you're making ethical choices, you are depowering and making things harder for yourself.
Yep, and that's... it's rage inducing. Like, Lucy's going to be mad. It's just going to be right. But yeah, you're right as well. So, like Avery is also concerning, because, like, the last thing she says to them before they break off is just like, yeah, so how about that, like, love scenario? It's made me think about how I have no prospects in this town.
Yeah.
So, like, we left the last Avery chapter in her head, like, already worried about her. And this is where we've left her here, is just being reminded that she's alone as long as she stays in town. And then, yeah, Verona obviously takes an hour to fall asleep. I think she's juggling with a lot of feelings of inadequacy and, like, she's not doing enough. So they're all just not doing great. This has been a big day.
Yeah, God. Yep. They're just not having that good of a time, are they?
Nope.
So they wake up and Jazz is not thrilled with them. They slept in too much, and obviously Jasmine has found out about the that Verona's drinking problem, let's call it. The fact that she spent $200 on bottles of water. She was out late drinking, and that's unacceptable. God, just everything's going to shit, Elliot.
As we get into this, I love how we sort of even start to have this place taken from us as like a safe haven away from all the magical bullshit. Like Verona sort of opens this segment as like Jazz is waking them up. She's doing that whole thing. She's like, she wakes up and she's like, oh, this isn't my home, but like, I feel safe here. I'm surrounded by people I actually like, which, you know, doesn't happen to Verona very often.
Mm.
She's got this sense of like, oh, this place is great. I have to remind myself it's temporary. Like she's doing this whole thing. I guess I'm curious what your read on it is. Like this mantra she has where she reminds herself it's temporary. Like, do you think it's a good or a bad thing?
I don't know. There's obviously some things that are helpful about it. It depends on the context of what she's applying it to, I guess, which if it's a mantra that she applies to positive things, then that's bad, right? Like, because it's self-fulfilling almost. Like,
yeah, but like, I mean, because it is right. Like, she, at this stage, she does have to go back to her dad's. So I think mentally keeping herself prepared for that, it seems like a smart move.
Yeah, I suppose. And I guess we haven't seen if she's going to apply it to things like, oh, my mother's acting really nice to me. Oh, well, I'm sure that's temporary. You know, if she's applying in that situation, obviously there's like a problem there.
Yeah. Right?
And we haven't seen that. So I guess we can't criticize Verona for that yet because she's technically correct.
Yeah. As long as she's just doing it in this case of literally this temporary accommodation, like it feels like it's a bummer, but like, it's important to remember.
Mm. Something I noticed on my second read through that I really liked, before Jasmine confronts Verona with the receipt or the, you know, the screenshot, she asks them, what were you two up to last night that has you so tired this morning? And it seems innocuous, but reading through it again, I was like, oh shit, Jasmine has given them a chance to come clean that they didn't take. She's so great.
It's exactly what they did to Edith the night before.
Oh, yeah. It's Jasmine, beautiful.
Yeah, she does the same fucking playbook on them, and they do the same bullshit Edith did where they're like, oh, you know, we just stayed up late talking about boys.
Yeah.
And Jasmine hits them with the receipt, her equivalent of the syringe, and it just goes so fucking downhill for them after that. I mean, it's painful, though, because obviously, like, it meant so much to Verona that she show Jasmine how much this means to her that she gets to stay here. So the fact that it's like pretty much immediately she's done a massive fuck up, and Jazz is absolutely masterful at playing the like, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed mum move. And like, I reckon Jazz knows how effective this was, because like the way Verona describes like her headache forming and like her gut dropping, like I bet you there were physical signs that she, you know, was feeling this distress that Jazz was picking up on. Because, it's just the biggest thing for Verona was she didn't want to do exactly this.
It clearly affects Verona so much, which is good. I mean, as it should. Like, she just spent $200 on water bottles. She should get in trouble for that.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is that whole thing where magic comes in as like that was a pretty good reason and they can't explain it and it's off. But also, like, yeah, you can't help but side with Jazz because this is just good parenting. unless they could tell her about the magic, she's just kind of unequivocally in the right from her perspective. And
I mean, she is in the right, 100%.
I think that's a little arguable if you know the whole context of what's happening to the town. But they can't tell her that. So it's a kind of moot point.
Yeah. So the Kennedys are exhausted from the night and from their punishment, I guess. Or for Verona and Lucy, at least.
Can we talk about the punishment? Because it's so, sure. It's so good. Like, yeah. If I ever have kids or anything, I'm totally taking this ethos forward. I fucking love it. Like, it's such a great teaching tool. Like, it's it's not punitive punishment. It's very rehabilitatory in that it's like, or like it's such a learning moment. Like she doesn't punish you for the sake of like retribution. It's very much, I am teaching you why you should not do this bad behavior by showing you how it can hurt you.
Mm.
It's so good.
Yeah, it is good. It's a very fun way to a very fun way to teach them about the problems with their choices.
Yeah, I'm like, just the framing is so well established as a, this isn't to be mean, this is to show you like that, you know, there's consequences. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's very good. So yeah, exhausted from that, the Kenneteers go to create all the shrines that Verona has promised and deal with a petulant wraith. And God, these shrine spirits are so adorable. this adorable bug spirit. Oh my God, it's like some cute thing ripped straight out of Hollow Knight.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Wabo intentionally made it a cute Hollow Knight character.
I don't know why, but I can't help but picture a lot of these like spirits in the shrine segment and the shrines. I'm just picturing it like Adventure Time style visuals.
Mm.
Like they're all just little adorable sort of cartoony things in their like weird little huts. Like, yeah. I don't know. Like, you're right. The bug one just wins your heart over so quickly.
I'm going to headcanon its name as Bapanada, by the way.
Oh, yep. That reference took me a second to get. Oh, yeah,
that's a year old reference for us now, isn't it?
It's a deep Game Club reference. Yeah, yeah. Like just as well. Like how great is that little moment where the bug spirit? It's shit gets knocked over, and Verona like runs over, and it's like distraught. And she's like, "Hey, do you want me to rebuild or like go beat that guy up first?" And you can tell it's like it just gets so relaxed by the knowledge that she will rebuild it that it does this little stomp and is like, go beat that guy up for me. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just this whole, like the whole concept of shrines, I've just instantly fallen in love with is just like these like little mini domains where you sort of theme a space for a nice critter. Like, I just love it.
Yeah.
I've already seen people on like Discord talking about like gardens where they want to have like little shrines and stuff. It's just so, it's such an addictive little idea.
Yeah, it's adorable. Yeah.
So they talk about here, they're setting up all these shrines or like along the barrier, with the idea being that the spirits are going to kind of help strengthen the barrier and maintain it and stuff, and it all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But briefly they sort of talk about like, oh gosh, I hope it doesn't do this to the barrier, and like I hope it doesn't interact with Monty in this way, and like Verona's setting up what she hopes will be protections against Monty. But the fact that they were kind of unsure made me realize they haven't consulted Charles on this. Like he's the barrier guy.
Mm.
Like,
yeah, interesting.
You would have thought he would be the one who would be like, oh, put this spirit here, put this spirit here. We've got to maintain this sort of balance. Like that is his whole thing. And I get the Kenneteers wouldn't have gone to him because there was that whole thing where he kept secret that part of the barrier that is designed to dampen their powers. So we can't trust him, but like the fact they're building these shrines isn't like a secret. Like there are a bunch of Kennet others involved.
Mm.
So what's the deal with that? Like, shouldn't Charles have an opinion on this? I feel like this is what he's for.
What's Charles up to at the moment? I know we talked about this recently. Is he alive?
What's he up to? But yeah, exactly. This brings up that question. Like, it's just he has to have an opinion on what they're doing with these shrines. And it's not a secret. So even if they don't want his opinion, it feels like they would have gotten it. Like it's just,
Charles's just raises that question where he is. Very suspicious, isn't it?
Yeah. For this segment where they're literally making changes to the barrier, his absence is extremely loud. Cause the other thing I couldn't help but notice, after I started to tinfoil about the lack of Charles is the Kenneteers like have a little speech they give to each spirit to sort of say, hey, you know, take some of our power, my blah, blah, work on this thing. The framing of that speech ties the spirits and their part in the barrier a lot more to the Kenneteers than to Kennet in general.
Mm.
Like, there's some sneaky claim shit going on this barrier, I think.
Yeah. Like,
and I can't help but feel that maybe that's something why they're keeping Charles a step away. Although it's been like 3 days. But like, I'm just, you know, with that idea of Charles kept secret the fact that it can depower the practitioners. If the Kenneteers have direct ties to the spirits who are forming a decent chunk of the barrier, that's going to have to matter if that comes up.
Yeah, definitely. It actually makes me think this is a great move by them.
I think it's a low-key, like, masterstroke.
A low-key masterstroke, for sure, yeah. Great work, Verona. Without even really realizing it, you've pulled out an improvised great play.
Yeah.
Pekka Snot turns into a water pistol. And that's great. That's awesome.
I mean, it's the bit where he turns back and he's vomiting up the mixture of sticky stuff and salt is just... I love goblins.
Oh, Pekka Snot, you're a champion. Forget about Tashlit. Pekka Snot should be Verona's familiar.
Oh, he's my boy. He just... I love the bit where he's like, where he just starts sticking her with shit. So she sticks him upside down on a tree and she's like, are you going to be good? And he's like, not. She's like, well...
Fair enough.
I mean, I'm just going to keep being worse to you. Like, I don't, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
He's such a guy. Love him. the last thing we've got to talk about in this section. So obviously they fight like another wraith here. And I feel like we've got to bring that up because it's just like, I was like, wow, another wraith, like in the same chapter. And like, this is a chapter where Verona has sort of spent the whole thing talking about like, I don't have stamina. I've run out of supplies. But when push comes to shove with this second, this second wraith, she immediately grabs some tools from nearby. Like, she gets Pekka Snot, and she like physically gets super involved in this fight. Like, she goes up, shoots it in the face, and then like rolls through it to get a sense of what it is. Like, Lucy doesn't get involved in this fight because she's too wiped, and like Verona kind of effortlessly actually takes her place as the kind of in your face fighter. For this fight. Like, I don't think she gives herself enough credit to how good she is in this moment.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Fair enough. She maybe she doesn't need her bag of tricks to be effective.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously still her way to play. Like, this is what she does when she's got no other options. But I hope she manages to give herself credit for the fact that, like, she does so well here. And it's a mixture as well. Like, it's her same move from last night where she intentionally goes inside the wraith to see what the deal is.
Mm.
But here she's also using it as she's like shooting it in the face. Like, she, yeah, like, she actually really steps up for this second fight.
Mm. Yeah. Good on her. We then jump 3 days into the future. The Kenneteers have been struggling, but Verona is taking a break by relaxing with Jeremy.
Yeah, basically the group as a whole has decided they're taking a rest day because apparently after 3 more days of this, they've only managed to set up 8 of the shrines out of 16.
Yeah, which is God. Just... Did they keep getting knocked over by wraiths or...?
I mean, yeah, presumably they've had to keep going back and like upgrading the other ones to protect them.
Yeah.
They've also probably been having to juggle the construction with like, you know, wraith hunting and echo hunting every night. I mean, yeah. It makes you understand why Matt and Edith were so fucking wiped all the time. Like, holy crap.
Yeah.
It's also, and again, it's just hilarious that Verona was like, just so casually, and again, without thinking forward to the consequences, just agreed to set up 16 shrines. And at the time when Lucy first brought that up, she's like, yeah, we'll just like set them up. And then it's like 3 days later, and she's just like, oh my God, we're only halfway.
But Verona and Jeremy time, that's pretty nice, right? Yeah. It's, they're adorable. I hope Verona doesn't mess up or break Jeremy's heart too much. She's obviously not very practiced at, like, human relationships, and she's obviously pretty good at putting her foot in her mouth. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, because it gets kind of awkward around this moment where she sort of, like, straight up admits that she's going to dish it out but can't take it when it comes to, like, teasing. I'm like, what's your read on this? Because I can't get it straight in my head. Like, it is unfair, but then also, yeah, I don't know.
Jeremy is going into this with eyes open, you know, like, despite the fact that I think they Verona could do more to be better about setting boundaries and et cetera, Jeremy is going into this with eyes open, and I think it's healthy for him to be able to make that choice and make mistakes, you know? Like, I don't think it's going to cause any long-term problems. I think it's healthy.
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, he calls Verona out on it being crummy that she can tease him, but he can't tease her.
Yeah, which
and
is good.
I think he's right.
Yeah,
like, but I don't know, like, because I guess, like, what do you do? Like, I don't know, like, because I guess you got to try and figure out why Verona can't handle it, but also needs to dish it out. Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know. I think it's very fair of Verona to, sorry, of Jeremy to call this crummy of Verona and maybe force her to self-reflect on it a bit more, because it is, yeah, I don't think it's fair.
Yeah. So this chapter ends with Rook giving Verona a phone call, right? Which I suspect means they're going to plan their next steps. That must be questioning Marisica, right? Like, they know she's suspicious as fuck, right?
Well, wait. Does she actually make a phone call, or is it more just like...
Well, not a phone call. You're right. Just delivering a message that they want to meet, I guess.
You're right. Like,
Verona's bullshit.
Yeah. But no, yeah, you're right. Marisica has got to be next on the list. Like, it just...
Mm.
That's where the talks have to go next. Like, she's the one that the next most confident is involved. But it's like a whole different can of worms going after Marisica than it is Edith. Like... They struggled for a good while to get Edith across the line. Like Edith was outplaying them words-wise until they dropped the syringe on her.
Mm.
Marisica is better at the words game, and they don't have a syringe to drop on her.
Yeah, like, they don't really have anything to pin her on, right?
No. Like, Edith had a few moments there where it looked like she was going to get away with it. There's no way that at the present, with the same skill set, they can nail down Marisica.
Mm.
So what do they do? And again, there's still that mystery of all that matters is that the Furs are in Kennet. Like, we still haven't quite figured out what the motivations are there. Like, even if we are turning it into a knotted place or whatever, why?
Mm.
Why would Marisica want that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, fuck. Who knows?
Yeah, you're right. I can't wait to see this conversation because it's going to feel like the start of the arc again, probably, where we're going to be asking a lot of sensible questions and tinfoiling and see where we go from there.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel like the playbook they've used so far will help at all.
Yeah, it doesn't, right? They don't have enough to arrest Marisica, I guess.
No.
If that's the metaphor we're going with.
Yeah. And it's a shame to see Verona, like, on her day off, get called away here.
I think it's great that they decided to try and take a day off and Verona's was cut short by this, because it's classic.
Yeah. Because, like, as you said, like, it was clear that Jeremy stuff was so good for her. Like, especially she uses him as a sounding board to, like, bring up a bunch of topics and ideas she can't really with anyone else without bringing, like, all the baggage with it. Yeah. It's a shame to see that get cut short, but that's what's going to keep happening over the next 2 weeks. They've got 2 weeks to all these deadlines sort of converge and the shit hits the fan. And it's going to be a turbulent 2 weeks.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But that's where the chapter ends with again, just this vibe of, like, things are going to be hectic for a while.
Yep.
But yeah. Before we wrap up the episode, though, we have to check in on some predictions left in our Pale Predictor form that you can find linked in the show notes down below. Predictions that our community has made about how this story is going to go.
Yeah. So what have you got for us?
I have a prediction from Hey, It's the Guy, whose prediction is that Silver is effective against all Fae except for Winter. So, potentially, we will get a scene where a witch hunter will fire a silver bullet or use silver against Guillaume, and everyone will be like, oh no! And then Guillaume will be like, haha, that doesn't hurt me, because now I'm a winter fairy, officially, and it's canon. And I think that's a very cool, like, cinematic moment, although it's maybe a bit too blunt for Wabo's style. But if something like that does happen, any kind of Guillaume being resistant to silver shenanigans, you know, they get props.
It does feel a bit closer to those fairy we saw in Toadspoiler's interlude, like the overly dramatic ones, because it's very, like, melodrama, like, oh, I've been wounded.
Yeah, you're right. It's very fae. Like, it's daytime TV type, which maybe does fit the fae.
Well, I got the impression that those fae in Toadspoiler's interlude were, like, the the shit fae that they don't let out yet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the bottom tier ones.
They're but, still yeah, practicing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The first draft.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends how you play it. Like, I guess I'm picturing it in this very daytime TV way, but maybe that's not what Hey, It's the Guy or Wildbo would do it, you know? there's other ways to play it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I do like that as a very, like, fairy drama vibe to it. Like, there's definitely, I think, room to play with that part of it.
Yeah, I do think it's just such a fun idea for a, like, cinematic moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
especially because it'd have to be, he'd have to be re-quoting himself as well. Because like the one big winter thing we've got so far is that he's like said the same thing twice. Like I want to see him like, it'll have to be like something that makes sense, but it's in a different context now, but he's already said it.
Yeah. You know, a witch hunter keeps trying to hit him with silver and he's dodging it. And then eventually the witch hunter lands it and he says, oh, you're being so blunt. I've expected better from you. Yeah. And oh, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. God, if it was that line again, three beat.
That's he's gonna turn into a fucking Pokemon where that's the only thing he can say. Anyway, what prediction did you pull out, Elliot?
I've pulled out one by Propaganda Pagoda, who has this wild prediction that I love, that there's like this whole bait and switch going on where basically the plan is for John to ascend, take the Carmine, but then the Sable will kill him, and so John will die because it's the Sable. And that means that the Sable takes the Carmine position, leaving his own seat open, at which point the Sable does some bullshit so John respawns and becomes the Sable.
Hmm.
Okay.
John as the Sable and the current Sable as the Carmine Beast. The problem with that is I don't feel like we have a characterization for the Sable that is beyond the fact that he has that role. Like, what is the Sable outside of being the Sable?
I mean, there's an argument that in the two chapters he was in this arc, he very much came across as somebody who was, like, pushing for, like, stricter punishment and, like...
Yeah, okay, I can see it.
Quite framed as violence, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to lie. Like, you know, much like a lot of my own theories, I don't give this one high odds, but I love it for its buck wildness. Like, because...
Yeah, I do love the wildness of it. You're right.
Propaganda Pagoda goes into, like, a bunch of stuff, like how it's a brilliant move from... the John and Sables thing, because it's kind of pulling the rug out from the conspirators, hopefully, because they're all focused on the Carmine. So the Sable doing the switcheroo, like sort of leaves John a bit safer because nobody's been going for his role and the Sable might be better as a Carmine. And then obviously it helps John escape his cycle of violence, gives him jurisdiction over Charles and sort of, puts him more in touch with like Yolda and stuff. So there's some cool ideas in this one, despite it being just absolutely wild.
I do like some of the good nuggets in it for sure. But yeah, thanks for leaving your predictions, everybody. Now before we go, we also have to visit some of our discussion question answers.
Yes. So for 2 weeks we've been running the discussion question: what's your opinion on Sylvia now that we've spent some more time with her? Is she a good mum or can she be?
Yeah, I think we got a few answers to this one. I want to start with some of the more straightforward ones, I think. There was a response from Beleg Tal who left a solid response. All of these responses went into a solid amount of detail and you know, cited things from the stories, but I've kind of summed them up here. I think the core of Beleg Tal's thing to me was like, she's an okay parent because while she's obviously made some mistakes, she very much cares about and respects Verona, which already puts her a cut above, you know, what she could be.
Half the parents in the story, yeah.
Yeah.
I the key phrase that jumped out to me from Beleg Tal's one was just that her heart seems to be in the right place. Like, I feel like that is, at the end of the day, like, the most important piece of the puzzle. Like, that's the thing that's going to help her get better if she's not good enough right now. Whereas, you know, like you look at Brett and like the problem with him getting better is that his heart's not in the right place. And like Connor is the other comparison, like Avery's dad. Like Connor's not great, but he seems to be trying and that helps a lot for me.
Yeah, you're right. It's your heart being in the right place. Yeah,
So speaking of Connor and stuff again, just while we're worried about Avery, and she mentions like how trapped she is in the town again, just a friendly reminder that when her mom moves out, it's going to be her living with Declan, Kerry, and her dad. Like that, Avery's home life is about to get just dog shit.
Yeah. It's going to get wild.
Like, yeah, it's her two worst siblings and her two worst siblings and her worst parent. And especially any support she was going to get is out the window. Like, her mom's the one who makes some of the efforts, and Sheridan's the one she's close to, and Rowan exists. But like, her dad is going to be drowning taking care of Kerry and Declan. Like, there's just no way she's going to get any attention at home.
Yeah. Yeah. How is it going to work out, huh?
I wonder if there'll be any of that effect of now being the kind of oldest in the household. Maybe she'll need to step up, and maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
Like, if she needs to take more of a role in caring for Kerry, is that there's a world where that could be a good thing. There's also plenty of worlds where it's worse, but, you know, sometimes that can actually improve things.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows?
Sorry. Weird tangent.
Pulling us back to Sylvia as a parent, I want to talk about a response from user Grundux91, who I think pulled out a really interesting point, which is Sylvia has made mistakes, but the thing that makes her a good parent and the thing that defines a good parent is, does she try and does she accept when she makes mistakes and learn from them? Which, yes, we have seen Sylvia do so far in the story, right? Like, we're seeing her getting better.
We've definitely seen her accept. Whether she's fixing them is probably, I'd still label that as TBD.
Well, Grundux pointed out as an example the fact that Sylvia wasn't going to and normally wouldn't, but decided to you know, stay the night in Kennet effectively to try and make more active steps towards bonding with her daughter, right? Like, that's a small example, sure, but, you know, Sylvia's only been in two or three chapters, so...
Yeah, I suppose I'd sort of counter that argument with something Megafy brought up in their answer, which is just they really had to twist her arm to get her to stay that night. Like, that wasn't necessarily her idea.
Like, yeah, true.
I do really like what Grundux brought up, and Beard of Valor brought it up as well. The whole aspect of the court-mandated contact is a positive, because I think some of the answers definitely brought it up as a bit of a point against Sylvia being a good mom, that like, it's kind of requiring court mandated contact to happen. But I'm willing to, like, Sylvia has sort of acknowledged, like, to Grundux's point, Sylvia has acknowledged, like, this is good for me. I think I need this to actually follow through with it. And so this will tie into, like, when we get into Megafire's answer proper, but like, I think that it's kind of like, to me, this is what gives me the hope and is making me willing to sort of say that she's becoming a good mom, just because she's realizing, just through like her own personality, she wasn't the sort of person who could maintain that contact with Verona. And so when like stuff is presenting itself to kind of force her to step up, she is jumping on it because like she wants to, she's just bad at it.
Yeah, she does want to take those opportunities. Does that count for much?
I think, like, yeah, it was. So this was really, like, I feel like where I ended up, Megafire's one is what brought up this point to me of, and this wasn't Megafire's point, this was my takeaway from their answer, but it's very much like, there's two sorts of ways of looking at this question. There's a lot of people who focused on, hey, she's trying, and she's trying to get better. But there's definitely this angle of, Sylvia seems naturally to have not been a very good mom. Like, her personality just maybe isn't a very good fit for being a natural mother, and she is having to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it almost turns into a bit of a semantic argument at this point of like, is a bad mom somebody who like is just kind of bad at the job, or does she become a good mom by being naturally bad, but now she's trying to get better? Because I feel pretty confident saying that naturally just Sylvia is not, she's not a natural mom. To Verona at this point. But the fact that she's trying to do better like wins her so many points with me, but I can see why somebody else would be like, that's still pretty shit. Like, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. The fact that she's she kind of made decisions based around her own goals and her own personality, which is normally a fine thing to do. But the fact that she's a mother kind of imbues her with additional responsibility to kind of, I don't know. I guess there's no real correct answer to that, right? Like,
yeah,
she's not naturally a mother. Sure. Do we cut her more slack? Maybe. Should we expect her to have known that about herself before she became a mother? I don't know. Mm. We don't know the circumstances of Verona's, yeah, like conception. So we can't really make any judgments around that.
Exactly. There's a separate argument to be had there about how she became a mother. If she maybe wasn't the sort of person who would, yeah, be a good one, or whether she should have known that.
Yeah.
But that's almost separate to the idea that what happened is this shit in their home happened. She ended up apart, and that definitely put her in the spot where she really couldn't, because of who she was, she really wasn't being a good mom. And like, yeah, how much do you blame her for the delay in her stepping up, I guess?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Megafires was talking about, you know, the difference between stepping up as an advocate and the difference between stepping up as a mother, with the key difference being like, yes, Sylvia was advocating for what Verona wanted, but sometimes that's not what a mother should do. And Mega said, in their opinion, Sylvia should push harder for things like having Verona live with her. Even if it causes some short-term friction, it's potentially the right move to be a bit more of a like tough love parent in some situations, right? Which is fair enough.
Yeah, but, and I think a lot of us thought that might be where it was going back, yeah, in like arcs 9 and 10.
Yes.
Because the parents don't know about the magic because Sylvia is not a practitioner, they have no context for how much it matters to Verona that she needs to be in the town. Like, obviously there's her friends and stuff and that's a factor, but like, I think Meg is right in that Sylvia would have a pretty easy time making the case without all the magic shit that it's better that Verona move and live with her.
Yeah, and I kind of agree with that. If we're putting aside the magic shit, e.g., from Sylvia's perspective, that would probably be correct. But it's potentially literally life and death for Lucy and Avery if Verona moves away. So, yes, you know, it becomes a much more thorny issue, I guess.
Yeah, and because it does suck that they're moving her from away from Lucy and all that, but like that just sometimes that's how it is, I guess.
Yeah.
For me, like I felt like the crux of Mega's point was, yeah, this way. It seemed like Megafire thought that Sylvia treats Verona a lot more like a friend in trouble than her daughter. Mm. Like advocating for her in this way that was like the sort of thing you might do for a very close friend. Almost more than like the emotional mothering and doing things like you said, like fighting for custody because believing that that would be the long-term thing. And this is where that whole idea came into my mind of like, yeah, like natural mothering and like how much you sort of naturally lean into that stuff. Like it just doesn't feel like that's Sylvia. And how much do we blame her for her own flavor of mothering? Mm. I mean, obviously it's failed pretty heavily for at least part of this, but yeah.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The last one we touched on briefly, but Peter Valor also sort of pointed out that Sylvia was so careful about not wanting to kind of disrupt or smother Verona that she was so distant that it's put this massive wedge between them and made things worse with Brett because Sylvia wasn't there. It's less about, I guess, judging Sylvia, but more sort of pointing out what went wrong and how she can be better going forward, I suppose, is the answer, which was just being more involved, which is what she's trying to do.
Yeah. I liked Peter Vela's response. Pointing out an improvement, I guess, not being overly critical or overly supportive. You're doing okay, Sylvia, but here's how you could have done better.
Yeah. I just can't help but be quite sympathetic to where Sylvia ended up. It sucks and she blew it, but like, oh, I could see myself ending up there.
Mm.
Depressingly easy.
Mm. Yeah.
I guess I'd like to think if I have kids, I would like do better, but you never know.
Mm.
That's the sort of thing you can't really comment on until you've got them, I guess.
Yeah, it's true. But thanks to everyone who left your answers to our discussion questions.
Yes. And in fact, we have a new one for the next fortnight.
Mm.
A new topic is, will Toad Swallow be a good leader? Who would you have put in charge? I guess this is basically just an excuse to rant about which Ken and others you think should be doing stuff.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear what people's response will be. I think I'd love to see some non-miss responses as well.
Yeah, sorry, no, miss doesn't count. Like, that's not...
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't answer miss.
Yeah. yeah. I'm interested, though, because, like, I'm interested to hear, especially besides Rook and Toady, what other options are there? Can anyone convince me any of those options are valid?
We'll see. I'd be interested to hear other picks.
Yeah.
Because we don't know if other people got votes. Like, we only saw the four votes go out, two for Toad, two for Crook.
Mm.
And then we know Toad won in the end, but, like, I think somebody on our Discord made the point that Cherry Pop probably voted for Cherry Pop in a very Pirates of the Caribbean, Pirate King election style vote. So, yeah, I hope we get to see more about who voted who.
Mm. Yeah, me too.
Anyway, let us know what your hot takes are.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, you can leave those hot takes in our discussion thread, which will be linked down in the show notes down below.
Yes, we're also on Twitter at Power Reflect Cast. The live reads are finally back on schedule. May has been kicking my ass, but I think I'm finally back on track. So, reading the chapters at the normal time, releasing episodes at normal time. It's all coming up, Milhouse.
Mm. Yeah. Why not, while you're at it, head on over to doofmedia.com and check out some of the other great shows on the Doof Media Network. I might draw special attention to What You Say, which has just started discussing the OC Season 4, with a little bit of baby updates as well, which is an absolute delight.
Yep. I continue to adore this podcast about a TV show I never have and never will watch.
If you want to support the Doof Media Network and all the things we put out, why not head on over to patreon.com/doofmedia? You get access to a whole bunch of cool perks by supporting us. We just today recorded our monthly Doof and Chill live stream, which is accessible to certain patrons, where we just kind of hang out and play games and chit-chat with our patrons, and it's a real delight every time.
Yeah, that's actually all patrons now. So,
All patrons. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Any old patron.
Yeah. We played GeoGuessr today. It was very fun. Some people are freakishly good at that game.
Mm.
Speaking of patrons, don't forget to stop by Walbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Walbo. His Patreon being up is the only thing that's keeping us from being flooded by echoes of bad stories.
Mm. Yeah.
Or other good stories. Wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that work? He's the Edith in this analogy, is the point I'm making, but in a good way.
Yeah.